This is disc number 8.
In his next session, he reported that his recurring dream had changed. This time, he went to visit his old house looking for adult possessions. The dream signaled that the part of him that had been deadened was coming alive again. I go to visit an old house. I don't know whose it is, yet it's mine. I am searching for something, not toys now, but adult possessions. There is a spring thaw, the end of winter. I enter the house, and it is the house where I was born. I had thought the house was empty, but my ex-wife, whom I felt was like a good mother to me, appeared from the back room, which was flooding. She welcomed me and was pleased to see me, and I felt elation. He was emerging from a sense of isolation, of being cut off from people and from parts of himself. The dream was about his emotional spring thaw and a mother-like person being present with him in the house where he spent his earliest childhood. It was not empty after all. Similar dreams followed in which he reclaimed his past, his sense of himself, and the sense that he had had a mother. One day he mentioned a poem about a starving Indian mother who gave her child her last morsel of food before dying herself. He couldn't understand why the poem moved him so. Then he paused and burst into an ear-splitting wail. "My mommy sacrificed her life for me!" He wailed, his whole body shaking, fell silent, and then yelled, "I want my mommy!" Mr. L., not given to hysterics, was now experiencing all the emotional pain that his defenses had pushed away, reliving thoughts and feelings he had had as a child. He was regressing and unmasking older memory networks, even ways of talking. But again, this was followed by psychological reorganization at a higher level. After acknowledging his great sense of missing his mother, he went to visit her grave for the first time. It was as though a part of his mind had held on to the magical idea that she was alive. Now he was able to accept, at the core of his being, that she was dead. The next year, Mr. L. fell profoundly in love for the first time in his adult life. He also became possessive of his lover and suffered normal jealousy, also for the first time. He now understood why women had been infuriated by his aloofness and lack of commitment, and felt sad and guilty. He felt, too, that he discovered a part of himself that had been linked to his mother and lost when she died. Finding that part of himself that had once loved a woman allowed him to fall in love again. Then he had the last dream of his analysis. I saw my mother playing the piano, and then I go to get someone, and when I return, she is in a coffin. As he associated to the dream, he was startled by the image of his being held up to see his mother in her open coffin, reaching out to her and being overwhelmed by the dreadful, terrifying realization that she did not respond. He let out a loud wail and, overcome with primitive grieving, his whole body convulsed for 10 minutes. When he settled down, he said, "I believe this was a memory of my mother's wake, which was conducted with an open coffin." Mr. L. was feeling better and different. He was in a stable, loving relationship with a woman. His connection to his children had deepened significantly, and he was no longer remote. In his final session, he reported that he had spoken to an older sibling, who confirmed that there had been an open coffin at his mother's funeral, and that he had been present. "When we parted, Mr. L. was consciously sad, but no longer depressed or paralyzed at the thought of a permanent separation. 10 years have passed since he completed his analysis, and he remains free of his deep depressions, and says his analysis changed my life and gave me control of it." Many of us, because of our own infantile amnesia, may doubt adults can remember as far back as Mr. L. ultimately did. This doubt was once so widespread that no research was conducted to investigate the matter. But new studies show that infants in the first and second years can store such facts and events, including traumatic ones. While the explicit memory system is not robust in the first few years, research by Carolyn Rovey Collier and others shows it exists, even in pre-verbal or barely verbal infants. Infants can remember events from the first few years of life if they are reminded. Older children can remember events that occurred before they could talk, and once they learn to speak, can put these memories into words. At times, Mr. L was doing just this, putting events he experienced into words for the first time. Other times he unblocked events that had been in his explicit memory all along, such as the thought, "My mommy sacrificed her life for me," or his memory of being at his mother's wake, which was independently verified. And still other times he retranscribed experiences from his procedural memory system to his explicit system. And interestingly, his core dream seemed to register that he had a major problem with his memory. He was searching for something but couldn't recall what, though he sensed he'd recognize it if he found it. Why are dreams so important in analysis, and what is their relationship to plastic change? Patients are often haunted by recurring dreams of their traumas and awaken in terror. As long as they remain ill, these dreams don't change their basic structure. The neural network that represents the trauma, such as Mr. L's dream that he was missing something, is persistently reactivated without being retranscribed. Should these traumatized patients get better, these nightmares gradually become less frightening until ultimately the patient dreams something like, "At first I think the trauma is recurring, but it isn't. It's over now. I've survived." This kind of progressive dream series shows the mind and brain slowly changing as the patient learns that he is safe now. For this to happen, neural networks must unlearn certain associations, as Mr. L unlearned his association between separation and death, and change existing synaptic connections to make way for new learning. What physical evidence exists that dreams show our brains in the process of plastic change, altering hitherto buried emotionally meaningful memories, as in Mr. L's case? The newest brain scans show that when we dream, that part of the brain that processes emotion and our sexual, survival, and aggressive instincts is quite active. At the same time, the prefrontal cortex system, which is responsible for inhibiting our emotions and instincts, shows lower activity. With instincts turned up and inhibitions turned down, the dreaming brain can reveal impulses that are normally blocked from awareness. Scores of studies show that sleep affects plastic change by allowing us to consolidate learning and memory. When we learn a skill during the day, we will be better at it the next day if we have a good night's sleep. Sleeping on a problem often does make sense. A team led by Marcos Frank has also shown that sleep enhances neuroplasticity during the critical period when most plastic change takes place. Recall that Hubel and Wiesel blocked one eye of a kitten in the critical period and showed that the brain map for the blocked eye was taken over by the good eye. A case of use it or lose it. Frank's team did the same experiment with two groups of kittens, one group that it deprived of sleep, and another group that got a full amount of it. They found that the more sleep the kittens got, the greater the plastic change in the brain map. The dream state also facilitates plastic change. Sleep is divided into two stages, and most of our dreaming occurs during one of them, called rapid eye movement sleep, or REM, REM sleep. Infants spend many more hours in REM sleep than adults, and it is during infancy that neuroplastic change occurs most rapidly. In fact, REM sleep is required for the plastic development of the brain in infancy. A team led by Gerald Marks did a study similar to Frank's that looked at the effects of REM sleep on kittens and on their brain structure. Marks found that in kittens deprived of REM sleep, the neurons in their visual cortex were actually smaller, so REM sleep seems necessary for neurons to grow normally. REM sleep has also been shown to be particularly important for enhancing our ability to retain emotional memories and for allowing the hippocampus to turn short-term memories of the day before into long-term ones. That is, it helps make memories more permanent, leading to structural change in the brain. Each day, in analysis, Mr. L worked on his core conflicts, memories, and traumas, and at night there was dream evidence not only of his buried emotions, but of his brain reinforcing the learning and unlearning he had done. We understand why Mr. L., at the outset of his analysis, had no conscious memories of the first 4 years of his life. Most of his memories of the period were unconscious procedural memories, automatic sequences of emotional interactions, and the few explicit memories he had were so painful they were repressed. In treatment, he gained access to both procedural and explicit memories from his first 4 years. But why was he unable to recall his adolescent memories? One possibility is that he repressed some of his adolescence. Often when we repress one thing, such as a catastrophic early loss, we repress other events loosely associated with it, to block access to the original. But there is another possible cause. It has recently been discovered that early childhood trauma causes massive plastic change in the hippocampus, shrinking it so that new long-term explicit memories cannot form. Animals removed from their mothers let out desperate cries, then enter a turned-off state, as Spitz's infants did, and release a stress hormone called glucocorticoid. Glucocorticoids kill cells in the hippocampus so that it cannot make the synaptic connections in neural networks that make learning and explicit long-term memory possible. These early stresses predispose these motherless animals to stress-related illness for the rest of their lives. When they undergo long separations, the gene to initiate production of glucocorticoids gets turned on and stays on for extended periods. Trauma in infancy appears to lead to a supersensitization, a plastic alteration of the brain neurons that regulate glucocorticoids. Recent research in humans shows that adult survivors of childhood abuse also show signs of glucocorticoid supersensitivity lasting into adulthood. That the hippocampus shrinks is an important neuroplastic discovery and may help explain why Mr. L. had so few explicit memories from adolescence. Depression, high stress, and childhood trauma all release glucocorticoids and kill cells in the hippocampus, leading to memory loss. The longer people are depressed, the smaller their hippocampus gets. The hippocampus of depressed adults who suffered prepubertal childhood trauma is 18% smaller than that of depressed adults without childhood trauma, a downside of the plastic brain. We literally lose essential cortical real estate in response to illness. If the stress is brief, this decrease in size is temporary. If it is too prolonged, the damage is permanent. As people recover from depression, their memories return, and research suggests their hippocampi can grow back. In fact, the hippocampus is one of two areas where new neurons are created from our own stem cells as part of normal functioning. If Mr. L. had hippocampal damage, he had recovered from it by his early 20s when he began forming explicit memories again. Antidepressant medications increase the number of stem cells that become new neurons in the hippocampus. Rats given Prozac for 3 weeks had a 70% increase in the number of cells in their hippocampi. It usually takes 3 to 6 weeks for antidepressants to work in humans. Perhaps coincidentally, the same amount of time it takes for newly born neurons in the hippocampus to mature, extend their projections, and connect with other neurons. So we may, without knowing it, have been helping people get out of depression by using medications that foster brain plasticity. Since people who improve in psychotherapy also find that their memories improve, it may be that it also stimulates neuronal growth in their hippocampi. The many changes that Mr. L. made might even have surprised Freud, given Mr. L.'s age at the time of his analysis. Freud used the term mental plasticity to describe people's capacity for change and recognized that people's overall ability to change seemed to vary. He also observed that a depletion of the plasticity tended to occur in many older people, leading them to become unchangeable, fixed, and rigid. He attributed this to force of habit and wrote, "There are some people, however, who retain this mental plasticity far beyond the usual age limit, and others who lose it very prematurely. Such people," he observed, "have great difficulties getting rid of their neuroses in psychoanalytic treatment. They can activate transferences but have difficulty changing them. Mr. L had certainly had a fixed character structure for over 50 years. How then was he able to change? The answer is part of a larger riddle that I call the plastic paradox, and that I consider one of the most important lessons of this book. The plastic paradox is that the same neuroplastic properties that allow us to change our brains and produce more flexible behaviors can also allow us to produce more rigid ones. All people start out with plastic potential. Some of us develop into increasingly flexible children and stay that way through our adult lives. For others of us, the spontaneity, creativity, and unpredictability of childhood gives way to a routinized existence that repeats the same behavior and turns us into rigid caricatures of ourselves. Anything that involves unvaried repetition, our careers, cultural activities, skills, and neuroses, can lead to rigidity. Indeed, it is because we have a neuroplastic brain that we can develop these rigid behaviors in the first place. As Pasquale Leone's metaphor illustrates, neuroplasticity is like pliable snow on a hill. When we go down the hill on a sled, we can be flexible because we have the option of taking different paths through the soft snow each time. But should we choose the same path a second or third time, tracks will start to develop, and soon we will tend to get stuck in a rut. Our route will now be quite rigid, as neural circuits, once established, tend to become self-sustaining. Because our neuroplasticity can give rise to both mental flexibility and mental rigidity, we tend to underestimate our own potential for flexibility, which most of us experience only in flashes. Freud was right when he said that the absence of plasticity seemed related to force of habit. Neuroses are prone to being entrenched by force of habit because they involve repeating patterns of which we are not conscious, making them almost impossible to interrupt and redirect without special techniques. Once Mr. L was able to understand the causes of his often defensive habits and his view of himself and the world, he could make use of his innate plasticity despite his age. When Mr. L started analysis, he experienced his mother as a ghost he could not see, a presence both alive and dead, someone he was faithful to yet was never sure existed. By accepting that she had really died, he lost his sense of her as a ghost, and instead gained a feeling that he really had had a substantial mother, a good person, who had loved him as long as she was alive. Only when his ghost was turned into a loving ancestor was he freed to form a close relationship with a living woman. Psychoanalysis is often about turning our ghosts into ancestors, even for patients who have not lost loved ones to death. We are often haunted by important relationships from the past that influence us unconsciously in the present. As we work them through, they go from haunting us to becoming simply part of our history. We can turn our ghosts into ancestors because we can transform implicit memories, which we are often not aware exist until they are evoked, and thus seem to come at us out of the blue, into declarative memories that now have a clear context, which makes them easier to recollect and experience as part of the past. Today, H.M., the most famous case in neuropsychology, is still alive in his 70s, his mind locked in the 1940s, in the moment before he had his surgery and lost both of his hippocampi, the gateways through which memories must pass if they are to be preserved and long-term plastic change is to be achieved. Unable to convert short-term memories into long, the structure of his brain and memory and his mental and physical images of himself are frozen where they were when he had his surgery. Sadly, he cannot even recognize himself in the mirror. Eric Condal, who was born at roughly the same time, continues to probe the hippocampus and the plasticity of memory down to alterations in individual molecules. He has further dealt with his painful memories of the 1930s by writing a poignant, informative memoir, In Search of Memory. Mr. L., now also in his 70s, is no longer emotionally locked in the 1930s, because he was able to bring to consciousness events that happened almost 60 years before, retranscribe them, and in the process, rewire his plastic brain. Chapter 10. Rejuvenation. The discovery of the neuronal stem cell and lessons for preserving our brains. 90-year-old Dr. Stanley Kuransky seems unable to believe that just because he is old, his life must wind down. He has 19 descendants, 5 children, 8 grandchildren, and 6 great-grandchildren. His wife of 53 years died of cancer in 1995, and he now lives in California with his second wife, Helen. Born in New York City in 1916, he went to Duke University Medical School, did his internship in 1942, and in World War II was a medic in the D-Day invasion. He served as a medical officer in the infantry in the European theater for almost 4 years, then was shipped to Hawaii, where he eventually settled. He practiced as an anesthesiologist until he retired at 70. But retirement didn't suit him, so he retrained himself as a family doctor and practiced in a small clinic for 10 more years until he was 80. I talked with him shortly after he completed the series of brain exercises Mrzenik's team developed with Posit Science. Dr. Kuransky hadn't seen cognitive decline, though he adds, "My handwriting was good, but not as good as it was before." He simply hoped to keep his brain fit. He began the auditory memory program in August 2005 by inserting a CD into his computer and found the exercises sophisticated and entertaining. They required him to determine if sounds were sweeping up in frequency or down, to pick the order in which he heard certain syllables, identify similar sounds, and listen to stories and answer questions about them, all in order to sharpen brain maps and stimulate the mechanisms that regulate brain plasticity. He worked on the exercises for an hour and a quarter, 3 times a week for 3 months. I didn't notice anything for the first 6 weeks. At about week 7, I began to notice that I was more alert than I had been before, and I could tell from the program itself, from the way I was monitoring my progress, that I was getting better at getting correct answers, and I felt better about everything. My driving alertness, both during the day and at night, also improved. I was talking to people more, and talking came more easily. In the last few weeks, I think my handwriting has improved. When I sign my name, I think I'm writing the way I did 20 years ago. My wife Helen told me, "I think you are more alert, more active, more responsive." He intends to wait a number of months, then redo the exercises to stay in shape. Even though the exercises are for auditory memory, he's been getting general benefits, as did the children who did fast forward, because he is stimulating not only his auditory memory, but also the brain centers that regulate plasticity. He also does physical exercise. My wife and I do muscle exercises 3 times a week on the Cybex machines, followed by a 30 to 35-minute workout on an exercise bicycle. Dr. Kuransky describes himself as a lifelong self-educator. He reads serious mathematics and loves games, word puzzles, double acrostics, and Sudoku. "I like to read about history," he says. "I tend to get interested in a period for whatever reason, and I get started, and I mine that period for a while until I feel I've learned enough about it to learn something else." What might be thought of as dilettantism has the effect of keeping him constantly exposed to novelty and new subjects, which keeps the regulatory system for plasticity and dopamine from atrophying. "Each new interest becomes an engaging passion. I became interested in astronomy 5 years ago and became an amateur astronomer. I bought a telescope because we were living in Arizona at the time and the natural viewing conditions were so good." He is also a serious rock collector, and has spent much of what many would call old age crawling in mines looking for specimens. "Is there longevity in your family?" I ask. "No," he says. "My mother died in her late 40s. My father died in his 60s. He had some hypertension." "How has your health been?" "Well, I died once," he laughs. "You have to forgive me for being the type of person who likes to astound people. I used to do some long-distance running, and in 1982 I was 65 years old and had an episode of ventricular fibrillation, an often fatal arrhythmia of the heart, on a practice run in Honolulu, and I literally died on the sidewalk. The guy I was running with was wise enough to give me street-side CPR, and some of the runners called the fire department paramedics, and they got to me quickly enough and zapped me and returned me to normal sinus rhythm and took me to Straub Hospital. After that, he underwent bypass surgery. He got actively engaged in rehab and recovered rapidly. I did not do competitive running after that, but I ran about 25 miles per week at a slower pace. He then had another heart attack in 2000 when he was 83. He is social, but not in large groups. I don't go readily to cocktail parties where people just come together and talk. I don't tend to like that kind of thing. I'd rather sit down with somebody and find a mutual topic of interest and explore it in depth with that person, or maybe two or three people. Not a conversation that says, "How do you feel?" He says that he and his wife are not strong travelers, but that is a matter of opinion. When he was 81, he learned some Russian and went on a Russian scientific vessel to visit Antarctica. "What for?" I ask. "Because it was there." In the last few years, he's been to the Yucatan, England, France, Switzerland, and Italy, spent 6 weeks in South America, visited his daughter in the United Arab Emirates, and traveled to Oman, Australia, New Zealand, Thailand, and Hong Kong. He is always looking for novel things to do, and once he's engaged in something, he turns his full attention to it, the necessary condition for plastic change. He says, "I'm willing to put pretty intense concentration and attention into something that interests me at the moment. Then, after I feel I've gotten to a higher level at it, I don't pay quite as much attention to that activity, and I start sending interest tentacles to something else." His philosophical attitude also protects his brain because he doesn't get worked up about little things. No small matter, since stress releases glucocorticoids, which can kill cells in the hippocampus. "You seem less anxious and nervous than most people," I say. "I've seen it to be very beneficial for people." "Are you an optimistic person?" "Not so much, but I think I understand what random events are. There are many things that go on that can affect me that are beyond my control. I can't control them, only how I react to them. I've spent my time worrying about things I can control and can affect the outcome of, and I've managed to develop a philosophy that enables me to deal with those." At the beginning of the 20th century, the world's most outstanding neuroanatomist, Nobel Prize winner Santiago Ramon y Cajal, who laid the groundwork for our understanding of how neurons are structured, turned his attention to one of the most vexing problems of human brain anatomy. Unlike the brains of simpler animals, such as lizards, the human brain seemed unable to regenerate itself after an injury. This helplessness is not typical of all human organs. Our skin, when cut, can heal itself by producing new skin cells. Our fractured bones can mend themselves. Our liver and intestinal lining can repair themselves. Lost blood can replenish itself because cells in our marrow can become red or white blood cells. But our brains seem to be a disturbing exception. It was known that millions of neurons die as we age. Whereas other organs make new tissues from stem cells, none could be found in the brain. The main explanation for the absence was that the human brain, as it evolved, must have become so complex and specialized that it lost the power to produce replacement cells. Besides, scientists asked, how could a new neuron enter a complex existing neuronal network and create 1,000 synaptic connections without causing chaos in that network? The human brain was assumed to be a closed system. Ramon y Cajal devoted the later part of his career to searching for any sign that either the brain or spinal cord could change, regenerate, or reorganize its structure. He failed. In his 1913 masterpiece, Degeneration and Regeneration of the Nervous System, he wrote, "In adult brain centers, the nerve paths are something fixed, ended, immutable. Everything may die, nothing may be regenerated. It is for the science of the future to change, if possible, this harsh decree." There, matters stood. I am staring down a microscope in the most advanced lab I have ever visited. At the Salk Laboratories in La Jolla, California, looking at living human neuronal stem cells in a petri dish in the lab of Frederick Rusty Gage. He and Peter Eriksson of Sweden discovered these cells in 1998 in the hippocampus. The neuronal stem cells I see are vibrating with life. They are called neuronal stem cells because they can divide and differentiate to become neurons or glial cells, which support neurons in the brain. The ones I am looking at have yet to differentiate into either neurons or glia, and have yet to specialize, so they all look identical. Yet what stem cells lack in personality, they make up for in immortality. For stem cells don't have to specialize, but can continue to divide, producing exact replicas of themselves, and they can go on doing this endlessly without any signs of aging. For this reason, stem cells are often described as the eternally young baby cells of the brain. This rejuvenating process is called neurogenesis, and it goes on until the day that we die. Neuronal stem cells were long overlooked, in part because they went against the theory that the brain was like a complex machine or computer, and machines don't grow new parts. When, in 1965, Joseph Altman and Gopal D. Das of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology discovered them in rats, their work was disbelieved. Then, in the 1980s, Fernando Nottebohm, a bird specialist, was struck by the fact that songbirds sing new songs each season. He examined their brains and found that every year, during the season when the birds do the most singing, they grow new brain cells in the area of the brain responsible for song learning. Inspired by Nottebohm's discovery, scientists began examining animals that were more like human beings. Elizabeth Gould of Princeton University was the first to discover neuronal stem cells in primates. Next, Eriksson and Gage found an ingenious way to stain brain cells with a marker called BRDU that gets taken into neurons only at the moment they are created and that lights up under the microscope. Eriksson and Gage asked terminally ill patients for permission to inject them with the marker. When these patients died, Eriksson and Gage examined their brains and found new, recently formed baby neurons in their hippocampi. Thus we learned from these dying patients that living neurons form in us until the very end of our lives. The search continues for neuronal stem cells in other parts of the human brain. So far, they've also been found active in the olfactory bulb, a processing area for smell, and dormant and inactive in the septum, which processes emotion, the striatum, which processes movement, and the spinal cord. Gage and others are working on treatments that might activate dormant stem cells with drugs and be useful if an area where they are dormant suffers damage. They are also trying to find out whether stem cells can be transplanted into injured brain areas or even induced to move to those areas. To find out if neurogenesis can strengthen mental capacity, Gage's team has set out to understand how to increase the production of neuronal stem cells. Gage's colleague, Gerd Kempermann, raised aging mice in enriched environments, filled with mice toys such as balls, tubes, and running wheels for only 45 days. When Kempermann sacrificed the mice and examined their brains, he found they had a 15% increase in the volume of their hippocampi and 40,000 new neurons, also a 15% increase compared with mice raised in standard cages. Mice live to about 2 years. When the team tested older mice raised in the enriched environment for 10 months in the second half of their lives, there was a 5-fold increase in the number of neurons in the hippocampus. These mice were better at tests of learning, exploration, movement, and other measures of mouse intelligence than those raised in unenriched conditions. They develop new neurons, though not quite as quickly as younger mice, proving that long-term enrichment had an immense effect on promoting neurogenesis in an aging brain. Next, the team looked at which activities caused cell increases in the mice, and they found that there are two ways to increase the overall number of neurons in the brain: by creating new neurons and by extending the life of existing neurons. Gage's colleague, Henriette von Prague, showed that the most effective contributor to increased proliferation of new neurons was the running wheel. After a month on the wheel, the mice had doubled the number of new neurons in the hippocampus. "Mice don't really run on running wheels," Gage told me. "It only looks like they do because the wheel provides so little resistance. Rather, they walk quickly." Gage's theory is that in a natural setting, long-term fast walking would take the animal into a new, different environment that would require new learning, sparking what he calls anticipatory proliferation. "If we lived in this room only," he told me, "and this was our entire experience, we would not need neurogenesis. We would know everything about this environment and could function with all the basic knowledge we have." This theory, that novel environments may trigger neurogenesis, is consistent with Mrazek's discovery that in order to keep the brain fit, we must learn something new, rather than simply replaying already mastered skills. But as we've said, there is a second way to increase the number of neurons in the hippocampus, by extending the life of neurons already there. Studying the mice, the team found that learning how to use other toys, balls, and tubes didn't make new neurons, but it did cause the new neurons in the area to live longer. Elizabeth Gould also found that learning, even in a non-enriched environment, enhances survival of stem cells. Thus, physical exercise and learning work in complementary ways, the first to make new stem cells, the second to prolong their survival.